MacCast, Monday, May 13th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another week of Apple and Mac news. And there has been a little bit of stuff going on. We have some things to talk about, maybe some new software updates to discuss, some new features coming to your Apple TV and your iOS devices. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple Pay this week. It's rolling out in a few other countries, and there's some new features coming to Apple Pay that are pretty exciting. Talk a little bit about AirPod 3s, a little bit more about that square cracker camera bump. Yeah, it might be growing, might be expanding a little bit. I'll explain what we mean by that here in a minute or two. We've got some new video content maybe coming to the Apple TV Plus service, some stuff on Apple Watch displays and other displays that Apple may or may not have anymore, a interesting rainbow structure showing up on the Apple campus. We'll explain what that is, some updates on Apple Card, and that will round out the news for this week. And then we're going to dive in to some feedback. I'm actually going to give you some of my thoughts and first impressions on some of the new Apple TV features. We're going to talk about a scary iCloud Photos message and one that you may come across and how you might deal with that. And then also talk a little bit about software and data recovery. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. Should be a good one, so I say we just dive right in. Starting things off with Apple Pay arriving in Iceland. If you are in Iceland, Apple Pay will be expanding into your region or has expanded into your region. Landsbankinn and Arion Banki, hopefully I'm saying that right, probably not, are the first two Icelandic banks that will be supporting Apple Pay. International payment solutions company Valitor had played a key role in bringing Apple Pay to Iceland, so it is available there now. Apple Pay is also likely to roll out soon in the Netherlands and Portugal. Banks in both those regions have promoting the feature as coming soon, but we don't have actual dates. As a matter of fact, I think Iceland represents about the 31st country to get Apple Pay. And you may remember back at the quarterly results call back in March, I think it was at that call, Tim Cook promised that Apple Pay would be available in more than 40 countries by the end of 2019. So with the addition of Iceland and a few more rumored to be down the road, I think they are going to hit that number before the end of the year. It'll be interesting to see if they go over 40 countries by the end of the year. But Apple Pay, obviously very popular and available in a lot of regions now. Apple Pay is also getting some new features. Apple Pay and wallet features were announced at the Transact conference this week in Las Vegas. As far as what you're going to be able to do, you will be able to now trigger Apple Pay purchases via NFC tags without needing a separate application or needing to install any software. The first three partners that Apple's going to be working with on this new tech is Bird Scooters, Bonobos Clothing Stores, and Pay by Phone Parking Meters. That means you'll be able to walk up to a scooter or a parking meter, clothing rack, tap your iPhone onto a special NFC tag, and it will automatically pop up, allow you to pay using your Apple Pay account without having to enter any additional information or even set up an account. It's going to handle that kind of stuff for you, and the initial rollout will be with those three companies, but expect it to be rolled out to other companies and services in the near future. Also, you are going to gain the ability to sign up for and add digital loyalty cards to your iPhone wallet app with a single tap of the NFC. And that is going to be a nice, convenient feature as well. So no longer having to wait and fill out, you know, you go to a retail store or something like that. They say, hey, you know, you could save X if you sign up for our loyalty program. I often decline that just because I don't want to take the time to actually fill out an application. If they can say, hey, just tap your phone here and boom, automatically I'm signed up and I get registered. That sounds very appealing to me, especially if I'm going to get some savings or discounts in the loyalty program. So I will definitely probably be taking advantage of that, and it'll just be another reason to use Apple Pay and Apple Wallet, and another reason that my iPhone is going to become a really convenient device to have on me. So I'm kind of excited about some of these new features. I'm also excited about Apple Pay quickly rolling out into other countries. I will tell you just a little update on Apple Pay here in the States. It does seem to be getting better. I'm able to use it in a lot more retail locations these days. I'm finding I'm using Apple Pay much more frequently, and the experience just seems to get better and better. So I was a big Apple Pay fan before, and I continue to be one now, and I can only imagine that these new features with the NFC tags and the digital loyalty program wallet thing, that's just going to seal the deal even more, at least for me. Will AirPod 3s cost more? It's looking more and more likely, and they might still arrive before the end of the year, something that I'm not super excited about considering I just bought new ones this year. But hey, some of the new features might tempt me, although I'm not sure the new higher price point will. The idea of a higher price point has been already floated around. I think we talked about it here on the MacCast, but now this week there seems to be new evidence to support the theory that that's exactly what's going to happen. Digitimes claims that the supplier of the PCB used for the existing AirPods 2, has increased their orders. And you might be thinking, well, how does that affect the AirPods 3, Adam? Well, it lends credence to the theory that Apple will continue to sell the existing models at their current price points. So the thought is that Apple is going to continue to sell AirPods 2 at the $159 for the Lightning case ones and the $199 US price point for the wireless charging case ones, and then they will come out with new AirPods 3s toward the end of the year that are expected to possibly have a new design and also a new noise canceling feature. That design would reportedly use a new system on a processor or system and processor design, and that would be what would drive the cost up, and also why again the current manufacturer sort of ramped up orders. So it's looking like AirPods 3s are not just going to replace AirPods 2. And that lends credence to this theory that they might cost a bit more. So we'll have to wait and see. Maybe toward the end of the year, probably around Christmas time, if they are going to launch them this year. Again, I'm hoping we won't see them until 2020, but knowing Apple, it's probably going to be a smart move to put some new ones out, especially if at a higher price point where they can gain maybe a little more profit. So I definitely wouldn't put it past them. New renders from Price Baba and On leaks of the 2019 iPhone XR are showing that device with the square camera bump that we've been seeing for the rumored iPhone 11 devices. And you might be thinking that's a little bit weird considering the fact that we had heard the iPhone XR was probably going to go to the two-lens camera system. Well, that square camera bump is there, and it is with a two-lens system in these images and rumors, these renders that have been leaked. It shows the True Tone flash and the mic where the third camera would be in the updated 2019 iPhone XS and XS Max models. And while you might be thinking, well, Adam, these are just renders and who knows what the source of the information for these renders were, it may or may not really happen. I would normally agree with you, but then this weekend, Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg posted pictures on Twitter of supposed iPhone molds that seem to exactly support all the rumors we had been hearing about the new camera systems on the 2019 iPhones, the iPhone 11 and the iPhone XR updated model, and all of them showing a square camera bump and lenses in the same orientations that we've been hearing about. So this rumor is looking to be very likely. As far as what the two cameras in the iPhone, the updated iPhone XR are going to be, it's looking like Apple is expected to use the wide angle and telephoto pairing that is in the existing iPhone XS models. The front-facing cameras on all three devices are also expected to get an update, being updated from 7 megapixels to 12 megapixels. The display on the iPhone XR, the updated iPhone XR, is expected to remain the same at 6.1 inches, and most rumors are predicting that it will still be an LCD display, although we have heard some rumors indicating that Apple could move to all OLED this year. I think they're going to hold off for another year. I think Apple's LCD display is pretty nice on that model. And just to keep costs down a little bit and profit margins up, I would expect them to maintain that LCD. The report also claims that the name of the iPhone XR could get an update. It may be called the iPhone XE. Not really sure what the E stands for. And the rumor is also claiming that the iPhone 5.8 inch and 6.5 inch models could be named the iPhone 11 and iPhone 11 Max. So finally, we get to go to 11 on something. Is anybody else tired of macOS 15, 16, 17? Is it about time we move to 11? I don't know. What's your opinion on that? But finally, we're going to have an iPhone going to 11, which I think is a good thing. Let the Spinal Tap jokes start flowing now. All three iPhones are expected to have a new updated A13 processor, and they're all expected to allow you to wirelessly charge devices like AirPods or other devices by placing them against the back of the device, so you will be able to have wireless charging from one device to another. Another thing we're hearing about with respect to the iPhone XE is that they could be replacing a couple of the colors. The current coral and blue colors are going to be supposedly replaced with new green and lavender options for 2019. And just some other good news for the iPhone XR. Data from Canalys shows that the iPhone XR was the best-selling smartphone in the U.S. for the first quarter of 2019. They say Apple shipped 4.5 million iPhone XRs, and that represents about 13% of the total U.S. smartphone market. Still, the report does note that overall, Apple saw a 19% decline in year-over-year iPhone shipments, but still maintained a 40% share of the U.S. smartphone market. So Apple doing all right, but obviously, as we've known for a long time, iPhone sales are in that slow decline, and Apple is turning to other things like their services and future products to kind of make up the slack. Finally, the site iPhoneSoft claims to have heard from a senior engineer at Apple that iOS 13 will not work on the iPhone 5S, iPhone 6, iPhone 6 Plus, nor the iPhone SE. So if you're an owner of one of those models, you might be a little bit disappointed at WWDC when Apple starts showing off some of the iOS 13 features. But don't get discouraged too quickly, because the report does seem pretty sketchy. It claims that iOS 13 will run on the A8-powered 6th-gen iPod, and that it also will run on the iPhone 6S. Interestingly, though, the iPhone 6S has the exact same processor as the iPhone SE, the A9. So why would it run on that and not on, on one and not the other? Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So I'm not sure where this information is coming from. Like I said, they said it was a, quote, senior engineer at Apple. I'm going to go out on a limb already and say that he's wrong. If it is running, if iOS 13 will run on an iPhone 6S, it's very likely going to be running on an iPhone SE, and especially if it's going to run on an A8-powered 6th-gen iPod. I don't see any reason why Apple would restrict it from those other devices. But we'll have to wait and see, and we won't have to wait very long, because June's coming up, Worldwide Developer Conference, and Apple should give us some details on the next version of iOS. Here's a little quick story on Apple Video Plus. I bring it up only because one of my favorite directors is looking to have a new show or a new series on Apple TV Plus. Apple has reportedly given the go-ahead to Jon Favreau for a new Apple TV Plus documentary series called Prehistoric Planet. It will reportedly use CGI to recreate the events from the last days of the dinosaurs, and I think it could be pretty interesting. We've seen other documentaries like this in the past, but given current technologies and the guy behind this one, I think it could be likely pretty amazing and some great new content for Apple TV Plus. So once again, the more and more I hear about Apple TV Plus, I'm getting more excited about it. I'm still tentatively cautious about what the price point might be. Hopefully Apple doesn't price themselves out of the market. I still maintain that I think they're going to stick with the $9.99 per month price point, keeping it consistent with Apple News Plus and probably their other services. And that could be a little bit too high given the fact that Disney Plus is coming in at, what, $6.99 a month? And they're going to have all the Marvel, Star Wars, and Disney content on that. Apple's going to have a little bit of a hard time competing with that. So I'm hoping maybe the price point will be a little bit lower, but we don't really know at this point. We just know that Apple TV Plus is coming and that it is a paid-for subscription service. But still excited about the new content and still looking forward to it. Apple Watch Series 4 was named one of the displays of the year by the Society for Information Display during their 2019 Display Industry Awards. The Series 4 display was specifically recognized for having the, quote, most significant technological advances and or outstanding features. What those features were, well, the two outstanding features, they say, were that it's a 30% larger display, but was able to maintain the same original device size, and that it uses a new technology called LTPO, or low temperature polycrystalline oxide, which improves the power efficiency, helping users get through the day on a single charge. So congratulations to Apple and the Apple Watch display for getting Display of the Year. Now, last year, the iPhones got one of those awards. And unfortunately, this year, both of them went to other companies, Samsung and Sony, for some of their display technologies. But Apple's still in the running, at least with the Apple Watch. And speaking of displays, specifically Apple displays, it's looking like Apple may be getting ready to finally release that new Pro display. And we could be seeing some of the first indications that they're ramping up for that launch. We know that Apple has been working on a Pro display. They told us years ago that they were going to release a new display along with the new Mac Pro. It is getting, you know, to be that time when we're expecting to see that. Some of us are hoping, myself included, that we might hear an announcement or at least something at Worldwide Developer Conference. Well, this week, it looks like Apple has possibly stopped selling the ultrafine 5K display that it co-developed with LG, at least on their online store. Now, you may remember that they stopped selling the LG ultrafine 4K display earlier this year. Now it appears that Apple Online is showing the ultrafine 5K display as unavailable. It could just be temporarily sold out, but a lot of folks are guessing that Apple is discontinuing sales of that display in preparation for the release of their own updated Apple Pro display, which is expected to be a 31.6-inch 6K 3K display. Now, this is not set in stone because it's not clear if it's just a temporary, you know, sellout of the LG display, but Apple did also stop carrying that 5K display in their stores way back in 2017 when there was a recall due to interference issues. So they never brought it back. You had to get it through the Apple online store, and now it looks like that isn't even available as an option. So Again, we're hoping we're likely going to get a sneak peek of that new Apple display at or around Worldwide Developer Conference. And if we do, hopefully it will be on sale shortly after that and available in the Apple retail stores. Because I know there's a lot of you out there who have been waiting for the return of an Apple display. And I think it's going to be probably a pretty amazing display, if Apple's history in displays is anything to be indicated. So exciting times. Again, probably going to have to wait for Worldwide Developer Conference to see if Apple lets us in on what they've been up to. A drone video this week came out of the Apple Park campus. Yeah, I know we haven't seen some of those in a while, not since the construction had sort of completed. But this time around, it revealed something very interesting being erected at the center of the Apple Park campus, a large rainbow. And it got a lot of people scratching their heads and wondering, what could Apple possibly be up to? Well, now from statements made by Apple and Johnny Ive, we know exactly what this thing is. It's actually a custom designed concert stage for events, and it's going to be used for the first time at a May 17th event celebrating the opening of the new campus and as a tribute to Steve Jobs. Specifically, it's called the Surprise Apple Stage, and it was something that was developed by Johnny Ive and a team of people, including Foster and Partners, the folks who worked on the design for the new Apple campus. They say they wanted something that was recognizable as Apple, and using the rainbow colors of the original Apple logo worked for that. They also wanted something that mimicked or paid homage to the structure of Apple Park itself, the circular shape. So they say the semicircular shape of the rainbow relates to the new ring shape of the campus quite nicely. The structure itself is designed to be easily set up and removed, although it's a pretty complex structure, as you might imagine. It has an aluminum frame skinned with polycarbonate, and it looks very, very cool. So I would expect a lot of times when Apple has these special events, they put out a video or some sort of press release. So if you haven't seen pictures of this thing from the drone, you're likely to see additional pictures from it as Apple puts out PR stuff after the May 17th event. I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of employees there as well, so we'll probably get some snapshots on Twitter and elsewhere. But it looks like a really kind of cool structure, and I'm super excited to see them going back to the classic colors, at least in this regard, at least using them and paying tribute and respect to those. I'm a guy who's been around with Apple and Apple products for years. I bleed the rainbow. I rock an Apple rainbow logo and on the back of my car and have for years. I have those few of those stickers still lying around, and I hold on to them dearly, use them to replace the one on my car every few years. Hopefully I won't run out of them anytime soon. So I really just like seeing those colors being prominently displayed on an Apple campus again. I think that's pretty cool. Looks like the first Apple cards are starting to make an appearance. They're starting to show up. Unfortunately, not for the rest of us. It looks like Apple employees are getting them first, at least if new photos posted by Benjamin Geskin on Twitter are to be believed. He says he received the photos from an Apple employee who received the card. He actually photoshopped out the name to protect their identity, put his own name in. And so some people were calling out the photoshopping on the photos, but it was done deliberately this time around. What's really cool is it shows off some of the packaging that the Apple Card is expected to have when it is released to consumers sometime this summer. The packaging is brightly colored and contains a hidden NFC tag that will be used to activate it. Wonder if that's like the NFC tags that Apple is supporting and we talked about earlier in this episode. I bet you it actually is. So it's a little tag that can be embedded in the card. When you get the package, or in the packaging of the card, rather, when you get the card itself, you hold your device near the tag and that will activate the card and match it up with the digital card that is already in your Apple Wallet. Because when you sign up for Apple Card, you're going to instantly get an Apple Card digitally, and then they will send you that new physical titanium one that has nothing but your name on the front, a mag stripe in the back, and then the name of the issuing bank, Goldman Sachs, and a MasterCard logo, but all of that etched into the metal titanium card. The thing is just so cool. I can't wait to get my hands on mine. And seeing the packaging is kind of exciting. It's going to be a really neat, seamless, I think, sign-up experience or activation experience. No number to call, no things to enter, just tap your phone right there and boom, your card will be activated. Like I said, though, we're not expected to be able to get Apple cards until this summer, at least here in the United States. I know those of you in other countries, unfortunately, are going to have to wait longer, but it looks like some Apple employees are getting to try out the card now. It'd be interesting to note or see if anyone ever sees one in the wild. Maybe if you work at a retail space or a restaurant or something in the Bay Area, if you see one of those and can get a picture of it or some information on it and send it to us, that would be awesome. maccast@gmail.com. But I'm getting excited for the release of Apple Watch. Hopefully they make them available earlier in the summer instead of later. You know, is the end of May the considered summer, right? It is, right? It's early summer. I don't know. Maybe June. We'll have to wait and see. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple has updated all the things, at least all of the software things or operating system things, I guess I should say. iOS 12.3, watchOS 5.2.1, macOS Mojave 10.14.5, and tvOS 12.3 have all been released by Apple. And get this, if you have a third generation Apple TV, you also get a software update. Yeah, you get a software update. You get a software update. You get a software update. We all get software updates. Actually, tvOS 7.3 for Apple TV Generation 3 is also out. Now, the biggest part of all of these updates, at least when it comes to iOS and tvOS, is that Apple has updated their TV app. Third generation TV owners also do get that TV app. And the big thing there is it has a new redesigned interface, new tabs, and also support for Apple TV channels, which let you watch and subscribe to certain TV content, subscription TV services from right inside the TV app without having to require an extra app download or anything like that. More on that a little bit later in the episode. Also, along with these new iOS releases, Apple did release the TV application and AirPlay 2 updates to select Samsung TVs. So you can actually, on some Samsung connected televisions, get the Apple TV app built right into your device along with AirPlay 2 support. That was something that was announced but has now been rolled out. WatchOS, as far as that update goes, the big feature there is it expands ECG features into Poland, Slovakia, Czech Republic, Croatia, and Iceland. And then I know along with bug fixes and some additional updates, and then also macOS 10.14.5. It contains mostly bug fixes and security updates. So all of those available now. You can get them by running your software updates on your various devices. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor. That's Malwarebytes. Hey, look, malware, whether we like it or not, it's a thing. Even on our Macs, adware, spyware, viruses, they're out there. Even if it's not something that may affect you, you may find a family member or a friend who gets hit. We in the Mac community, we stay diligent. Apple tends to have our backs and keep us protected, but it definitely is not always enough. Things can happen even to the best of us. One wrong click in the wrong place and boom, you might have something on your Mac that you need to deal with. And that's why I think it's awesome that we in the Mac community have Malwarebytes. You've likely heard me mention Malwarebytes on the show in the past, even before they were a sponsor. That's because I think it is easily the best and simplest software tool that you can use on the Mac to quickly scan, remove, and prevent malware. One thing I really like about it is that you can use it however best fits your situation. So for me, I scan it when I need it or think something has gone wrong. Other users, you might want to let it actively and proactively keep your Mac safe. The choice is really up to you. They use proven technology that absolutely crushes the growing threat of Mac malware. Malwarebytes scans the average Mac in under 30 seconds, so it's fast. And remember, like I said, it's easy, removing adware and unwanted programs that can actually slow down your Mac. So it's good for performance as well. And when you need more active protection, Malwarebytes can detect and remove viruses, ransomware, and other malware in real time with their advanced anti-malware technology. It can catch dangerous threats automatically, so you're protected without even having to think about it. Finally, cybersecurity smart enough for the Mac. Visit malwarebytes.com/Mac for your free download and a 14-day trial of their premium offering. That's malwarebytes.com, malwarebytes.com/Mac. And a big thank you to Malwarebytes for their support of the podcast. As I mentioned, with this latest iOS and Apple TV update, the big thing, or one of the big new features, is the new TV app. And a big part of the new TV app is the Apple TV channels. And I thought I'd give you my first impressions and maybe explain a few things, because if you're like me and you're looking at the new TV app, at first I couldn't quite figure out what the difference of Apple TV channels were. I already had a number of the apps for the different channels installed on my Apple TV, so I wasn't entirely clear on what the differences were. And I had to poke around a little bit and play around with it. And what I knew was that Apple was claiming, hey, you can use the app right inside the TV app. You don't have to install any additional application. So I was looking at it. And for me, the one service that I already subscribe to is HBO Now. And so I was looking at it from the HBO perspective, trying to figure it out. So when I went into the TV app and scrolled down, I saw all of the new Apple TV channels. And those channels are in a section called Available TV Channels inside the TV app. And they are separate services and not the same as the apps for the service that you'd normally find and download from the App Store. So the services Apple is supporting out of the box with this first release are HBO, Showtime, Stars, Cinemax, Epix, Smithsonian Plus, PBS Living, Acorn TV, Sundance Now, Lifetime Movie Club, Urban Movie Channel, Taste Made, Curiosity Stream, MTV Hits, and Comedy Central Now. And as far as I've been reading, I think these are all available in 100 countries right now. So they're not region restricted like normally they would be when rolling out through the other mechanisms. Don't quote me on that, but from what I've been reading, it sounds like that's the case. All of these channels also are offering a free 7-day trial of the service. You can, in a single click, kind of sign up to try the service out. It will be tied to your iTunes account, but you would need to go back in within the 7 days and cancel that trial. Otherwise, they will just automatically start charging you for the subscription. So just be careful with that, but you do subscribe via an in-app purchase subscription made through your iTunes account. Again, you can do all of this without downloading an additional app from the App Store. Now, I already had the HBO app on my device, so this is where my confusion set in, because I thought, well, okay, maybe I can just access this new channel right inside the Apple TV app and just get access to my HBO subscription, which I already paid for the HBO Now subscription through iTunes. So when I clicked on the channel inside the TV app, I was surprised to find that it asked me if I wanted to sign up and subscribe to the service. And when I went through the entire process, it did create an entirely new subscription attached to my iTunes account. So I now have an HBO Now subscription, and I have the free trial, the 7-day free trial of the HBO on Apple TV subscription. So they definitely are separate, even though they're both tied into my iTunes account, which is a little bit weird. And I didn't see a way to just sign up or activate the Apple TV channel, the HBO on Apple TV service, using my existing HBO Now subscription. If it is possible, I missed it. And if I do figure out a way to do that, or if you happen to know a way to do that, let me know. Shoot me an email, mattkess@gmail.com, and we'll try and share that information. I also did notice that when I signed up on my Apple TV, like I said, it did call the subscription HBO on Apple TV. Despite what that name says, it did activate that subscription service on all of my devices that were linked to my iTunes account. You can also share that account with up to 5 other family members if you use family sharing. So this is a way where multiple family members could get access to a premium service or channel through the TV app on their devices. I haven't tested this out yet, so I don't know what happens when a family member signs in, if they need to also sign up for the service. I also downloaded and then installed the HBO Now app. Well, I had it installed originally, but I tried deleting it once I signed up for the new service so I could tell, hey, does it work without actually needing to have the app installed? And it definitely did. And then what I thought was, I want to re-download the HBO Now app because now I have this new account, right? Can I sign in and still use the HBO Now app? I was curious if I could use that account in case I was on another device, something that wasn't my Mac, or maybe I just wanted to access it through the web. So I did download the app again. I tried signing in through my iTunes, and it did prompt me to create a new HBO Now username and password, even though I already had one that was set up with my old account. So I was actually able to still use the HBO Now app with my HBO on Apple TV subscription. So just something to note. Again, I don't know if this works the same way for all the other services like Showtime, Stars, and Cinemax. It may be specific just to HBO. It could vary from service to service. So take all of this with a grain of salt. Again, these are just my first impressions in working with and playing around with the new Apple TV channels, specifically the HBO channel. Now, as far as how the experience goes using the HBO channel inside the TV app, it's a little bit awkward for me, I think, accessing it the way you have to access it, because it wasn't entirely clear. Just as you would expect, in the Now Playing section, everything is kind of mixed together, so it will make recommendations for HBO and some of the other channel services and things like that. But I was more curious, how do I actually go in and just access HBO content without going to the HBO app? If I'm inside the TV app, how do I get to it? And the only way I could figure out how to do it was to go down to, again, that available TV channels section in the Now Playing tab and then tap on HBO. Now, the first time when I hadn't signed up for the HBO on Apple TV app, it prompted me to sign up for the service. Now that I actually had an account, it just went right into the HBO content. What was interesting, though, is it put it in a display that looked exactly like a standard Apple TV display with the tiles for the different content. There were the see all links. So if it showed recent movies in a section, then I could click see all and it would show all of the recent movies and content. When I scrolled down, it did get to a section that was the various categories that I was used to seeing inside the HBO Now app. So there were categories like series, movies, kids and family, all the ones that I would expect to see. And then down at the very bottom, there was actually a watch live option with feeds for both the East Coast and the West Coast. And I don't remember that being available inside the HBO Now app. So HBO Now, I thought, was only on-demand stuff. I don't think it had actual live feeds. But with the Apple TV channel, that does seem like something that was accessible. You could also select seasons in there. So if you went into a particular show, it had a drop down for multiple seasons. You could go through and see what you had played, what you hadn't played. You, of course, can add things into your up next list. There's a button for that. There's also a share button to share what you're watching. And if you use the HBO channel, and this is something that I've been reading that is currently exclusive to the HBO channel on Apple TV and no place else, not even in any of the other HBO apps, you can actually download shows for offline viewing. So there's the little cloud icon with the download arrow on content in the HBO channel. Clicking that will allow you to download it, save it locally. So if you're getting on a plane or just want to have something stored locally because you're not going to have access to Wi-Fi, you would be able to do that from inside the app, at least, again, for HBO stuff. So overall, it's an interesting experience. I'm not so sure how I feel about it being just like everything else inside the TV app. It might get a little bit better once we have a dark mode option, but right now it's all light and white, and I don't know. It just feels sanitized, if that makes certain sense. I like it. I like the fact that it's homogenous and it's the same experience that I'm used to. And I know that like the individual apps often get a lot of flack for being bad. Some people really don't like the HBO Now app. I actually kind of like it. It kind of worked for me. Although if I'm being honest, mostly use the TV app anyway, because that content was tied into the TV app. So I would just go to my Now Playing section in the TV app and just access most of the content that I was watching from there. So it'll be interesting to see how much I like using the HBO channel inside the TV app versus using the Now Playing app itself. I'm going to try to stick with just the Apple TV app for a while and let that experience sort of grow on me. And I'll continue to share my thoughts and opinions on it moving forward. I'd also like to know your thoughts and opinions, especially if you're using some of the other services. So if you're using Stars or Cinemax or Epix or any of the other services, let me know how that experience is going for you. Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Now let's talk a little bit about something that Apple is occasionally guilty of, and we come across these every once in a while. What I call the scary pop-ups or scary messages when you're doing something, usually related to some form of iCloud syncing, right? So you go to do something in iCloud, maybe turn off an iCloud service, like say contact syncing, and it gives you these warnings about data that it's going to delete. Well, this week, Luis was helping out a friend with their iPhone, and one of the things they were doing was setting up iCloud Photo Library for them, and they got a sync message that popped up and was pretty scary. It said, quote, "Photos synced from iTunes will be removed. Syncing photos via iTunes is not supported when iCloud Photos is turned on. 2,698 photos will be removed." And then the buttons they were offered were remove photos or cancel. And it was at this point when the cancel button was pressed and I was contacted. Because really, anything telling you that it's going to delete about 3,000 photos from your device, yeah, that's a scary proposition, and you want to know what you're getting into before you press that remove photos button, right? And in this case, I definitely think it helps to know why you're getting this message, Luis, and what will happen if you say remove photos. So a little bit about the idea behind iCloud Photo Library, I think, is important. And the idea, of course, is that your entire photo library will sync via iCloud and across all of your devices. And so you'll have access to everything in your photo library from whenever and wherever you might be. So whatever device you're on, wherever you might be, you get access to your entire library. In order for this to work, though, you need to kind of define one location, most likely a Mac, as kind of the main system library, the centralized repository that is going to contain all of your original photos. And I generally recommend you pick a Mac that's set up for this, something that you have multiple backups on, and that sort of thing. We'll talk about a little bit more about the backups here in a minute. But you set up that one main library, and then in that main library, you also want to make sure that you have the option on that library to download and keep the originals, something that you set in the preferences inside the photo app. And this, again, would be the machine also that you have your Time Machine backups, you have other backups of your photo library, including probably an offsite backup, something other than just syncing to iCloud, unless you want to totally 100% trust Apple with one copy, one in-cloud copy of your data. I think Apple's pretty good with that stuff, but I just don't trust anyone, any single source with all of my data. So that's kind of the idea behind it. Now, the old way of getting photos onto your device was doing a sync via iTunes, and it sounds like this is exactly what the friend was doing. So in the past, you'd connect either directly with a lightning cable or through Wi-Fi, you'd connect your device to iTunes, right? You go into iTunes, you'd select the device, then you'd go to the Photos tab, and you would choose various sync options. So you'd say, hey, I want to sync this device, I want to sync this album, or I want to sync all of my photos, whatever it might be. And then you would manually actually copy or sync the photos to your device. And this is how your friend's phone is currently set up, and that is why you're seeing that error message. It's actually what it's referring to. It says, hey, you've got basically almost 3,000 photos that were synced over to this device. We are going to remove them so that we can then use iCloud Photo Library to do the syncing. And the reason you can't leave those already synced messages on there is that iCloud Photo Library is actually going to copy over your entire library to the device. So essentially, you would wind up with duplicates of those. Those 2,698 photos should be currently already on photos on that Mac, or that's the presumption, and that's the thing it's warning you about. I say it's assumed they're on there because I don't know when the last time your friend maybe synced all of their photos from their device over into Photos. And so before saying, yes, remove the photos, I would check on a couple of things. One, I would connect the device to the Photos app and make sure all of the images from the camera roll and from the device are imported into Photos. I'd also check that the images in Photos and on the device are the same, that there are, the photos that you're expecting, those 2,698, that those photos are sitting in the photo library on the Mac, because ultimately when you enable iCloud Photo Library, that's what's going to sync to the device. So you'll remove those almost 3,000 photos and then sync those all the way all back onto the device through iCloud Photo Library. So once you've done everything, oh, and then finally, too, I'd make sure that there's a backup of the iPhone. So make a backup of the iPhone through iTunes, and then also a backup of the photo library that's on the Mac. Make sure there's multiple backups of that. Just again, so in case anything goes wrong, and it likely won't, but just in case, you have that backup. So once you've done all that, you should be able to enable the iCloud Photo Library. You should be able to safely remove the photos. And then what should happen is iCloud Photo Library should kick in, start doing its thing, and should sync all those photos from the Mac onto that iOS device. And again, on the iOS device itself, you probably want to go in and choose the optimized device storage option. So when I say it syncs everything to that device, if you're using the optimized device storage option, it's actually going to just be syncing thumbnails of everything. It's not going to eat up all your storage space. It's going to leave most things in the cloud. It kind of manages all of that. And the way you can check that setting is go into settings on the device, into photos, and make sure the optimized device storage option is on. And that would be on anything that wasn't the main photo library, the main system library. Again, on the main library, you want to make sure you have the download and keep originals option. You can have the download and keep originals option on multiple devices. There's no problem with that, other than you need to make sure whatever device that you're doing that on has enough available storage to support whatever size photo library you're trying to sync over there. And just keep in mind that once you do start the syncing process, especially if you have a large photo library, it can take a very long time for everything to sync. So if you don't see everything right away, like those 2,698 photos don't come back instantly, don't worry. Wait some time. Give it probably a couple days, maybe a week or two to finish all of its syncing. I have a like 20,000 image photo library, and the first sync definitely did take, I think, about a week. You know, depending upon your internet connection and when it's available, it's going to be doing it in the background, so you don't need to worry about it. It's just kind of a set it and forget it kind of thing. All you really need is a lot of patience. So hope that clears things up for you and Luis, and I think it's great that you're helping out your friend with this, and that you're being cautious about it, because sometimes you can see these messages and one wrong click and things go very, very south. So thanks for chiming in and asking that question. And speaking of things going very, very south, you know, I always talk here on the MacCast about backup, and there really is a big reason why. Well, one reason why is I've been burned by not having my own backups. So I do it because I want you to learn from my huge mistakes in my past. The other reason I do it is because I absolutely hate getting emails or messages that go like this. Hey, Adam, you know, you've always talked about backup, but... And then that but is followed by some sort of story about a catastrophic drive failure or something that happened to a device, lost, broken, and in some way the person cannot recover their data. And then it usually ends with, especially if it's a Mac or a hard drive, can you recommend some good file recovery software? And I hate getting these because while there is good file recovery software out there and even some great file recovery services, those solutions are often expensive, and very often you don't get all of your data back if you can get any of it at all. Like, there's no guarantee that data is coming back. A lot of times it can, but I am kind of the opinion, why risk it? And even if you do get that data back, it's often a huge mess that then you have to wade through, because we're often talking about thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of files and data, and the recovery software very often does not bring back any of the directory structure. So what you end up with is just one single level, basically folder or volume with all of your data shoved in it. And a lot of times even the original file names are gone and you just have gibberish. And so you're having to open up every image, figure out what it is. It's just a giant nightmare, and it's not worth it, because for $100 or so, you can have an external drive, you can get yourself a copy of Carbon Copy Cloner or some sort of great backup software, and just make some backups. So, you know, that's why I harp on you about this, because I don't want to get these emails. And even if you have backups for your really important data, I would stress back up your backups. Make sure you have extra copies. And what I mean by this is, you know, do that locally for your most valuable and critical files. Of course, also have some sort of offsite or offline backup, usually of your entire data set, but you know, for me, I make a lot of extra copies of my very critical files, and I store those locally just in case my, you know, drive crashes or something happens to my iPhoto library or my photos library becomes corrupted. I actually have extra copies of that photo library just here locally in multiple places. I also make extra copies of my email and important documents like my Maccast files, all my original files of the Maccast, those are in multiple places. Also, my client files, the stuff that I work on that I make money off of, you know, my web development files and things like that. Yeah, I back all that stuff up normally, and then I make extra duplicate copies here locally. And I have a few different techniques for this. I've run through them on past episodes of the Maccast, but I'll just give you a summary here. So for my photos library, for example, I have Time Machine backups, I have clone backups, I have Backblaze offsite backups, and then I also have a ChronoSync task that copies the iPhoto library to two different Drobos, one directly connected to my Mac. And of course, the Drobos themselves have data redundancy on their drives. And then the other Drobo connected to my 2006 Mac Mini on my network. Yeah, that's my little like file server. And so I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 copies of my photo library, including one offsite backup. A lot of you might think that's crazy, but guess what? Those photos are ultra important to me. Like, of any of my data that I have on any of my Macs, that is probably my most important, my most critical data. Those are memories. Those are photos of my kids growing up. I would be devastated if those were ever lost. So I just make absolutely certain that I'm never going to lose that data. Same for, you know, my email. That's important communication. A lot of times it's my client communication. It's stuff that I need to have. So again, Time Machine backup, Carbon Copy Cloner backup, Backblaze backup, and then I use a program called Mail Steward, which actually goes through all my mail folders and extracts that data, puts it into a MySQL database or a SQLite database, and then that file itself also gets backed up to all of those same locations. So I will never, ever lose an email. And then finally, for my documents folder or my critical documents, like I said, Maccast files, my client files and things like that. Again, Time Machine, clone backup, Backblaze offsite backup. And then for select critical folders, they get backed up to the Drobos, again, using a ChronoSync task. And for those, I actually use a special option that ChronoSync offers that says don't sync deletions. So if the source folder, my Mac, I go in and I delete, say, a Maccast episode, because I can't keep all of those stored locally. I run out of storage space. I can delete it locally, but I know that it will not be deleted from those two Drobos. So I have two copies here on my network, one again connected to locally to my Mac and the other over on the network that are backed up of those files. Now, the only dilemma there is that that means I only have two local copies. I don't have an offsite copy. So some of you may have already spotted the flaw in this. This is, again, for older Maccast files, for older client files, stuff that I've just cleaned off my local drive. I do ultimately need to figure out a solution for that. I haven't done that yet. I probably should set up some other, you know, ChronoSync task or some other task to move that stuff into the cloud. Now, Backblaze and Time Machine will have somewhat of a history of that, but eventually those will be, you know, sunsetted out and deleted. So I need more of a long-term solution that is offsite, just in case I have a catastrophic, you know, fire or something at the house and I lose both Drobos. But for now, that's kind of my process. You don't have to follow that. You can come up with kind of your own solution, but I thought I'd share with you sort of what I'm doing, maybe just to give you some ideas. So again, there are lots of options. I think this only illustrates the point, right? There are lots of options for having local backups. The absolute two, if you don't do anything else that I recommend, is doing a Time Machine backup and some sort of offsite backup like Backblaze. That's the service I like. I used to use CrashPlan until they stopped doing a home service. And so at this point, I think Backblaze has one of the best offers. It's $5 a month. It lets you back up one Mac, all of your connected drives, network drives. I mean, it's unlimited storage. There's no reason not to do it. And just get one plan for each Mac. You know, even if you're spending $15 a month, that's going to be the same amount that you're going to spend on your entertainment, say like HBO or some sort of subscription service, you know, TV service, and it's really not a lot to pay for the security of your data, right? Because again, if you need to go down the route of getting some recovery software or sending out to a recovery service, it is going to cost you. And in case you need it, there are good ones out there. I hope you never do need it. But just in case, the ones that I would recommend, Data Rescue from ProSoft. I think that's some great software. I've used it to help some friends out. I've had to use it once or twice for myself. Like I said, I learn from my past mistakes. Don't need to really use it much anymore. But if you have to, you can get that application. I think it's around $99, $100. But again, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to recover that data. Another option is Disk Drill Pro. I think it's about $89 for the paid version. They do have a free version, but I think that just provides protection. I don't believe that it allows you to actually do data recovery on your drive. To do that, you do need to pay for the pro version, so you're going to have to step up. If you have Set App, I do believe that Disk Drill is part of the Set App subscription, so you might be able to get it that way. And then worst case scenario, if you can't recover it with software on your own, there are services like Drive Savers. They are absolutely fabulous. They do forensic data recovery. They can recover almost anything. It's really pretty amazing, the process that they can go through, but you're going to pay for the privilege. You're looking at, you know, prices I've heard from people are a minimum of $800 to $1,000 to recover your data. That's a lot of external hard drives that you could buy and just do that backup yourself and never need a service like Drive Savers. So I think that's the better route to go. That's my advice to you. But hopefully this gives you just some things to think about and some options. And again, you know, I don't fault anybody for making that mistake that many of us have made and ultimately needing one of these recovery services. Hey, look, stuff happens. I'm not here to berate you about it. But I am telling you a little proactive effort can avoid a lot of headache if you'd like to avoid that. So there's a couple of ideas for how. And with that, hey, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me your emails and audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.